Hello and welcome to Blogosphere Serious Influence, the podcast all about the business side of the influencer industry. I'm Alice Audley and I'm the founder of Blogosphere. We run events, an influencer network, a magazine, and now a podcast too, which I'll be presenting. If there are any questions about the influencer industry that you want answered, be sure to tweet us your suggestions. Our Twitter handle is @BlogosphereM. Today on Blogosphere Serious Influence, I'm joined by Gio West, who is an influencer marketing expert with over 12 years' experience. Gio has worked for the likes of Benefit, L'Oreal, Charlotte Tilbury, and also set up her own influencer marketing agency, Happy Cat. She now works at EA Games.
My name is Gio James, and I guess I'd call myself a creator marketing expert. I currently work for EA Games as their creator and influencer content producer for the global channels.
Amazing. And you got into this industry you're an early adopter, one of the first, really.
Yeah.
So take me back to, you know, how did you get into to where you are today? What was your starting point?
Yeah, it goes back right to the beginning, actually. Kind of 2008, when I was a college student, and I was a really avid watcher of YouTube, and I used to love to read all of the, you know, the kind of fashion blogs at the beginning and the beauty blogs. And I was a bit kind of, I've always been quite technical, and I've always been quite into media production and things like that. And I thought, you know, there's kind of an opportunity to earn a bit of money here. So I started reaching out to some of the bloggers and saying, hey, I could redesign your website for you, or I could help you build a YouTube channel if you wanted to kind of branch out your content a little bit. So for, you know, as a teenager, I was building those connections and kind of being part of, you know, no one was earning money at this point. It was all hobbyists, but just kind of, I was earning money. No one was earning money from brands, but I was kind of getting, you know, a tenner here and there to kind of help someone with a new blog logo or whatever. And then when I was at uni, I studied video production, and I managed to wangle my way on set to a New Look kind of model shoot. And one of the models that they brought in was Patricia Bright. And we kind of got talking, and she, you know, she's always been super. So this is what, 2012 at this point.
Yeah.
She's always been super, you know, the reason she's got to where she is today is because she's a business mind first.
Her background was in, wasn't she at Merrill Lynch, or she was at a bank?
She's in finance. Yeah, that's right. And it still wasn't a full-time thing for her at all at that point. It was still kind of very much like the early days of brands partnering. But she was like, hey, you do film. I could do with a bit of help to kind of scale what I'm doing. So we partnered up. I used to get the train up to where she was living at the time, and we, you know, I'd help her shoot a bunch of stuff, and then she'd sometimes send me the rushes and I'd edit it for her and send it back to her. You know, I had an editing suite, you know, for free at university, so I'd kind of, you know, go down there and I'd do a bit of my uni work, and then I'd do a bit of work for Patricia. And then at the same time, I met Jack and Finn Harries online, and I became one of their employees as well. So I was doing a lot of copywriting for the Jack's Gap blog, their website. I'd help them out a bit with their YouTube videos as well. And then it kind of, you know,
and is that, so that's 2012 as well?
Yes. Yeah. So I was still a student at this point.
How long did you stay with Jack and Finn?
I was with them for a year. And then I broke up with the guy I was seeing at the time, and he, we shared a laptop that was actually his. So,
right.
I had to, you know, I wouldn't have like regular access anymore. And they ended up being in my final film for uni. I did a documentary on how there was this rising group of young people who were dominating the internet and starting to figure out ways to earn money through social media channels. And at the time, my lecturer was like, don't you want to pick something that's a bit more kind of realistic? Like this, you can't, you know, it feels quite tenuous and far-fetched. And I was like, no, I really see.
Wow.
I really see potential in this industry. And I see people like Patricia and people like Jack and Finn who were already taking it really seriously. And building businesses, you know, that they had, they were using, you know, the YouTube space in London, the original one, and, you know, hiring out the studio and bringing in loads of kit. And it was, you know, it was like proper serious stuff, and the content they were making was really creative and really cool. And
because were Jack and Finn doing, because they've moved more into documentary, environmental, yeah, at that time, were they doing brand partnerships? And when you were with Patricia, what was it, more from a press perspective that she was being sent stuff and it was just to add in and relationship build, or when do you remember that it started to get monetized?
So around sort of 2013, 2014, when I was graduating, Patricia, like, my role kind of shifted a little bit, and it was less just kind of helping her pump out really cool content, and it moved more into, okay, this brand has sent me this message, can you help to negotiate, you know, that the fee is quite low. And, you know, back then the fees were very low. It was, you know, dozens of pounds versus what, you know, yeah, what we're talking about now. But, you know, even then Patricia was like, I know that my value is more than this, but can we try and figure out what that looks like? And also she didn't want to be the one having those awkward conversations with the brands. And it's kind of where the birth of, I guess, like, talent management, and this is why Dom was setting up Gleam at the same time, and it was starting to become, you know, people wanted a layer between the creative and the brand, I guess mostly because it is a bit awkward to have those, you know, 2 weeks of back and forth over, you know, the money, and the brief even can sometimes get a bit hairy, and the contracts is quite hairy. So it's funny, I had that, I guess, like, the naivety of youth at that point, where, like, even now I look back and I'm like, I was like 18, 19 years old. I probably shouldn't have been in charge of all of these contracts and things. But at the time I was like, yeah, sure, I have no idea what I'm doing. That's just kind of, no one else knew what they were doing either. So
it's much easier to negotiate on behalf of somebody else than when you're doing it for yourself as well.
Yeah, that's true. It is true. And also, yeah, the brands were all like, how much do we pay for this? We've never done this before. And Patricia was like, I've never worked with that brand before, I don't know how much budget they have. And it was, you know, they didn't have, there were no influencer marketing managers at the brands. It was all the PR normally, or they were using a PR agency. So it was like the press budget that they were using, the what, you know. So, you know, it was quite a bit of like a free-for-all at that point, I think, because it was, there were so few people monetizing it then.
So you were doing the editing and helping out with the content, and then went into this sort of, it sounds kind of like management-esque.
Yeah, it kind of fell into that, I guess, just because, you know, I guess from Patricia's point of view, she only wanted people close that she could trust. And, you know, her sister was working with her husband, ended up working on the same team, and her cousin. So I was very much kind of in the family at that point, and she really took me under her wing, and it actually, the role evolved. So when I then moved to London, and I was working for a charity just to kind of get a check, like, that was kind of covering London rent for the first time. And after about 7 months of doing that, Patricia brought me in full time to work for her, and she matched my salary, which was really cool. And, like, she had an office by that point, so all of us were kind of working together in this office space. And then the role evolved into, actually, she needs someone to go on behalf of her to events now, because she's getting invites for 4 or 5 different events on the same night. And she wants some representation there and someone to pick up her goodie bag for her or whatever, to help have conversations with the brands about what we could do with her career and the brand in partnership and things like that.
That does show again the importance of actually being places and face-to-face.
Yeah, because absolutely, you know, if you're not there, the brand's not thinking about you a lot of the time. There's so many people, and as the industry was growing, there were more and more people coming in. It would have been quite easy for her to kind of fall out, I guess, of some of those brands' lists, just because, you know, just for not showing up or accepting an invite.
What would you say was your biggest learning from working with Patricia during that time?
I think I just had to grow up really fast. It was there was so much responsibility in the work I was doing with her, and I made a lot of mistakes. We got under each other's skin quite a lot, kind of towards the end of our working relationship, because it had been years by this point, and there was an imbalance to the relationship, because, you know, I had no money. Okay, we both came from no money, but she is older than me, and she'd had this amazing career that she'd built for herself. She'd started to already be one of the biggest people in the industry by quite a lot. She was starting to break America. Like, this was all before she even had her first baby. So, you know, I think she was still very young and still kind of quite inexperienced in a lot of ways as well. But she had so much more to teach me, and I think.
So although like the fees were lower, suddenly it did, you know, some of the campaigns that were being won, it was like test and learn. But some of the big corporations did throw a lot of money to just have a go.
They did. So, and some of those profiles, you know, Patricia included, were giants compared to, you know, the industry was still very, very small at that point. There were still mostly Gleam talent and a few not Gleam, but Patricia was independent at this point, but there was, I would say, like dozens of people, especially in the UK, who had that massive following, and everyone else was that kind of amateur level still. And then the money was big for those, the big guys, kind of by 2014, when I was full-time for Patricia, like the contracts we were getting were big, and I, you know, I'd never been responsible for any amount of money like that before, and it was crazy. It was a lot of pressure to kind of, you know, make sure that I was paying all of our, you know, I'd look around the room and everyone in that room was on salary paid for by the money that we were earning for Patricia's brand. So you know, you kind of could see the fallout of if this still doesn't go through, or if we undercut ourselves or anything, you know, all of us are kind of relying on this money coming in.
Do you think that, like, what were the campaigns that were coming in? What did they sort of look like? What did the brands want at that time? And do you think, having been in the industry for such a long time, that it has dramatically improved the kind of quality of campaigns? Or do you think there's still a long way to go?
So at the time it was, for example, Minions, the film, did a collaboration with Selfridges, and there was like a bunch of kind of designer clothing and bags and things like that that were all kind of using the Minions motif, and one of the pieces was this, like, it's quite funny, I guess, you know, tastes change quite a lot, but it was this leather jacket that was worth quite a lot of money. I think it was like probably £700 or £800, this leather jacket. I think it might have been, I don't know what brand it was actually, but it had, you know, like Minions kind of eyes and things all over it, and little insignias and stuff, and they sent it to us, and they wanted us to put a picture and some sort of like integrated video of Patricia wearing it for like hundreds of pounds, which at the time, you know, 2013, this would have been like hundreds of pounds for what we were doing was just taking a picture and putting it on the internet. You know, it wasn't really much more than that at that point. It was still quite low budget. I was like, why are they giving us this money for doing that? Like, I didn't, even though I believed in the industry, I didn't fully see, because that money was so much more than I would ever, you know, have been used to kind of handling. I was just like, God, that's how much I would be earning just, you know, in a month sometimes, some of the campaigns we were doing, just for one picture or one 3-second shot in like a total like outfit of the week video.
Was it mainly YouTube then at that time?
It was, but then we actually started, now that she had this team, we started to build our other arms of the brand. So we launched something called the Refuel Room, which was during London Fashion Week. It would be a hub that the bloggers could come to kind of between the shows, or even the girls who maybe weren't getting invited to shows but just wanted to be part of Fashion Week and get the pictures. And it would be somewhere they could go. We had a bar, we had like food partners, we had a salon with, like, I think we partnered with like Tony and Guy or something like that, so you could come get your hair topped up, you could get your makeup topped up. We had some clothing brands in there, so you could pick a different outfit for the next show. We partnered with Rihanna's Fragrance at the time, where they had cabs, they had like black cabs that they were like, you know, covered in the branding. Yeah. So we were like zooming people around to the shows. So that, you know, that kind of added another layer of sponsorship. So we kind of partnered with Simple Skincare, and they were doing goodie bags of like how to take all your makeup off at the end of Fashion Week or whatever. And it was, you know, there were kind of other things, and it was more creative than just those.
Okay. Were they doing that in kind, or were they doing it like as a paid partnership as well?
So some of it was in kind, some of it was just kind of an exposure thing. Some of it was they were paying to appear at this event, and we could get, you know, we showed them the guest list of people, and we had Patricia's name to help on both sides, to help get people into the Refill Room as bloggers and to get brands in, because, you know, she was a star in the industry at that point when there weren't that many stars.
Yeah, absolutely.
Her name carried a lot of weight.
Yeah. So then when did you leave Patricia, and what happened next?
So I left Patricia in 2015, right at the end of 2015. Our relationship, it was starting to get quite tense. We both have, we still talk, we have a lot of mutual respect for each other, but I think we both had grown a lot in the years that we'd worked together. She was pregnant at this point, and her life was changing. Her brand was kind of going in a different way. I was really struggling to figure out where my career was going to go if I was kind of her assistant for the rest of my life. And I didn't, you know, we didn't see a way of me growing much more in the way that I wanted to working with her. So we parted ways. Probably it was like November, December of that year. I actually did a weird stint through a friend of a friend. I was brought into Adele's 2016 tour, running the VIP packages. It was supposed to be paternity cover for the guy that was like the head of operations there. And again, in hindsight, I feel like I was way too young to be doing this job. But I think by this point, I'd actually been doing quite a lot of responsible
But also, you're stuff. Because you got in so early, you may have been young, but you're actually more educated than most people many years older than you. Like, the experience you had is, like...
Yeah, I felt very confident. I knew exactly what to do. I had the contact. You know, I had all of the agency contacts by this point. Again, you know, thanks to my work with Patricia, I actually knew all of the PRs, and so that was, yeah, a really fun time. And it actually, it was kind of a crossroads in my career, because I was at the same time, after about 3 months of doing that role, I was offered an in-house position at Benefit Cosmetics. And before I'd landed this Adele role, that would have been like an absolute dream, and those roles were still so few and far between. It was in their marketing team, and I was very aware, you know, there aren't actually that many brands who are doing influencer marketing, and even fewer brands who have an in-house team that are doing it, because a lot of them were outsourcing, and a lot of them still do outsource to agencies. And I loved makeup, and I, you know, I loved that side of things when I was working with Patricia. So I was at this crossroads of, I'm about to go traveling around Europe with Adele, or this kind of not once in a lifetime, but kind of once in a blue moon job is on the table. And I think everyone told me that I absolutely should take the Adele job, but I was just so afraid of saying no to this. It was very heart and head. My heart wanted to go on tour, and my head wanted to think about my career, which is silly when I think about it now, because I was, you know, I had my whole life ahead. I was like 22 or something. Like, but at the time, it felt like if I turned this down, it would be really hard for me to get my foot back into that world. And obviously I don't regret the decision, because, you know, everything that followed I wouldn't change. But yeah, I had to talk to my boss at the VIP package and say, like, yeah, you're right, this is a really cool job, but I can't take it. Thank you. Thank you and goodbye.
So you went to Benefit.
Went to Benefit.
And then And they were doing stuff in-house as opposed to working with agencies. So yes. What was your position when you got to Benefit?
So I started out as an events assistant in the promotions team. And it was kind of, it wasn't just influencer work. It was, influencer was kind of a facet of the role, but we also were doing things like running the events in store. You know, they used to do, I don't even know if they still do this, but they used to do these like payday party Fridays where in all of the little boutiques like up Carnaby Street and stuff, we'd have free champagne and like, it was so fun. It was really fun. It's a fun brand. And they also, at that point, they weren't doing, no one was really doing those kind of like lavish trips and things. So it's not, when people hear that I worked at Benefit, I think they think that I was part of that kind of era of let's all go to Hawaii or Mexico or whatever. It wasn't, the industry wasn't even there at that point. We were just hiring out like a little venue in Leeds and inviting down all of the local northern influencers to come and network or whatever.
It was Benefit's Maldives trip that was the first sort of, when was that? That was about what?
That was 2017, because that was the year that I left. It was after I'd left, actually, that trip.
Now, Benefit, actually, hot topic at the moment, are a bit in the firing line with their trip to Hawaii.
Yes.
What are your views on that?
It's funny. I really thought that we were kind of past that, the kind of big, lavish luxury trips.
Yeah, for listeners, Benefit have done a press trip to Hawaii where they have taken a variety of influencers, some of whom are from the UK, but there have been multiple social videos from Hawaiian residents talking about how they don't need more tourism, there are water shortages and other things, I think in a nutshell.
Yeah.
And so there is a little bit of backlash on social. Yes. I think when the first time there was a big trip, it was, wow, what a statement for this industry that they're being taken as seriously as mainstream press. Mm-hmm. And it was a real sort of testament to the strength. But then it sort of, and it was benefit, you know, this is the trip. But then it sort of was kind of emulated by lots of other beauty brands. And so I think it kind of got lost a bit and what the brand actually was for all of the trips.
Yeah, I think I really didn't like that era of the industry at all. There were, like, you're right, there were a handful of years, probably 2017, right up until the pandemic started, where it was just a mess. It was just so much, it was so lavish and so, you know, not sustainable and really exclusionary, I think. It had this real kind of elitist, I really didn't like it, and I understand it's really hard to not get swept up in all of that. You know, I never was involved in any of those big trips, but even, you know, when I worked at L'Oreal, we launched a range of skincare, which was inspired by the vineyards of the south of France. And so we took a small handful of press and influencers out to the vineyards and, you know, to meet the people involved in the making. And it made sense. It was a bit tenuous. Did I enjoy spending 3 days in the sun, you know, all expenses paid? Yeah, absolutely I did. And I get why, if your PR director says, hey, let's all go to Mexico for a week, you know, and it's going to be VIP luxury and we're going to have loads of fun, like I can imagine it's really hard to be the person in the room who's like, oh, I don't know if we should do that. Of course you want to go. Yes, it makes a splash for the brand. I do think that the product launches often get really lost in those trips. It's like, you know, we used to watch at L'Oreal, we were really studying a lot of those trips to kind of see, like, you know, what's coming out, like who's going on these trips, what's the sentiment for the brand and stuff. And a lot of the time it was like, what's the launch here? Like, what are they advertising? Like, is it, you know, is it a lipstick? Is it a mascara? I can't actually see anyone talking about product. I'm just seeing a lot of cocktails and beaches. Yeah. And, it, you know, it became, yeah, I don't think it was a high point for our industry at all. And I thought we were past that. I thought the pandemic had kind of drawn a line and had proven that we can drive a lot of impact and also work with a better base of people, a more diverse base of people, if we're doing things more virtually or kind of smaller scale. But apparently not.
But it's back.
Yeah.
Strangely said, that was the era, and then it took us right up to the pandemic. And then you realise actually how long ago it was that the pandemic started.
Yeah.
So after you left Benefit, then you went to L'Oreal. Yes. Your next step?
Yes, that's right.
I feel that this is such an varied career. So this is...
there's a lot.
We'll get to your views, but now let's just track where you were.
Yeah.
L'Oreal...
L'Oreal, this was 2017 at this point.
What was the role?
The role was social brand manager for L'Oreal Paris, and I was in charge of all skincare, all men, like men expert, and all tan products for the UK. But we were kind of, a lot of the work that we were doing was kind of like the best in class for this, you know, like the Nordics and Germany and things like that. So we kind of, I guess, were like the European team. But it was a big role. And this was, and I think this is still an issue in the industry, is a lot of those roles are, they expect so much of the individual. So I was the person who was kind of, at the beginning, shooting all of the content that was going on our Instagram, Twitter back then, sometimes getting involved in some of the content that was going on our YouTube channels, like for the brand, but then all the way up to casting and being on set for like our celebrity TV campaigns and taking press to Cannes and stuff. So it was, you know, a lot, the role had a lot of different things that I had to try and be good at.
Yeah. Is that the first sort of position where you were working with creators where you were given significant budget, like to then commission work from creators?
Yes, it was. The budgets were on Men Expert quite small, on the rest of L'Oreal Paris very, very big, and the biggest I ever worked with so far, you know, nearly 10 years into my career already at that point, really. And yes,
and did you get a say in which creators, you know, you wanted to have in the campaigns?
Yeah, absolutely. There were a few of us who kind of, so there was also somebody who looked after all of the hair brands, and there was someone who looked after all of the makeup brands. And then we kind of reported into the PR director. But it was kind of up to us and our little group who we thought the brand should be working with. On the smaller scale, you know, obviously when it came to like the giant TV campaigns, there was like quite a big layer of corporate sign off, which is frustrating because then you suddenly have a load of people who have no idea what they're talking about, having a lot of sway. That was still the era where things were quite clicky as well. So I kind of feel like when you had, there was kind of like the in group, and, you know, at that time it was the beauty squad. People who were on those big retainer contracts, and there weren't that many of those back then, those kind of like 12 month, you know, seven sometimes figure contracts. But again,
and what did those contracts sort of look like? Was that you're on a retainer for 12 months? On another episode of the podcast, I was interviewing Mel Kentish, and she was talking that everybody that they work with is on a long-term retainer. They don't do things just one-to-one because it works so much better. But what were the sort of contractual obligations within a year-long contract? Is that anything from four posts a month or, you know?
So the way that we did it, which I think works quite well, and it's something that I still try to adopt kind of as much as possible. I don't think 12 months is that good in this industry anymore. I think the industry moves way too quickly. You know, a lot of things can happen, either, you know, scandalous or political or whatever, that means that 12 months kind of being tight for both sides, you probably don't want that length, but maybe 6 months I think is a good length. And having just a bucket of deliverables. So within that, there would be three YouTube mentions, one dedicated YouTube video, 10 Instagram posts with stories, and one event attendance and one photo shoot attendance or something. And then the brand could then dip into those deliverables as and when we needed to throughout the year. It kind of, it gave more flexibility for both sides. It wasn't just every single month we need something from you. It's like, okay, I know in advance that we're going to go big on Mother's Day and we're going to do something big when this product launches in June. So let's make sure that we're kind of pigeonholing, and I would keep them as like a little, a bank of deliverables that I knew I could pick from. And then it meant that I, you know, I had my other pot of budget, which I was spending throughout the year on different campaigns with different creators and different events and things. But I always knew I could, I've also got that video with Ruth Crilly that I can use in May when I need to or whatever.
Mm. So were you at L'Oreal when Monroe situation happened?
Yes, that was my first month.
Whoa!
Yeah, and everyone else was out, actually. It was, I was the only kind of social brand manager working there at the time.
Quite a busy first month.
It was busy. It was, I was the first one to spot from the brand side that basically my work phone crashed because the notifications that were coming through from Twitter were coming in so fast that I couldn't even open the Twitter app. And it was like 7 a.m. or something. And I was like, this feels like not a good thing. And I haven't been here long enough to know whether this is something that happens often, but no one has told me to expect something like this. So I texted my boss and I was like, I can't get on to Twitter, but I feel like something bad is happening. He sent me back a screenshot of he'd managed to get on his laptop. And then he was like, right, let's kind of rally a crisis kind of reaction team. And then it was completely taken away from me. I was, you know, I was really junior still.
Yeah.
Conversations happened way above my head. We were then told how to react to it. I don't even think we had to post anything. I think it was people more senior were the ones kind of putting out the statements and things. We were told what to say if we were asked anything at the time. But in terms of decision making, I found it a very traumatic period. I think a lot of the people I would see as like my peers at the time felt that was a really traumatic process because our hands were so tied by our employer. But we, because we were under the umbrella of the brand, the reputation that the brand was getting was kind of reflecting on all of us as well. And it wasn't, I wouldn't say that we shared a lot of the views that the brand shared at the time. And I don't think a lot of us agreed with the reaction that the brand publicly put out. But we had to kind of go along with it because we were on payroll and we were all too scared to speak up. And
I think that's quite one of the biggest sort of battles that this industry has had, is that the people that do understand it have often been in the more junior roles because it's such a new industry.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but maybe this is actually something that it will grow out of because people will understand now, you know, people are getting into more senior positions. The industry is becoming more respected that you don't just shut the door and, you know, just cancel. You think about it a bit more clearly and, realize that reactions, you know, online, it's a digital tattoo that stays with you. So you really got to think about it. It's not just a newspaper here, gone tomorrow. Everything now is.
And I do, like, I actually think that that was a real watershed moment for the industry because the way that Monroe and her team managed it, and they were very mature and professional and collaborative about that process. I think, you know, they could have gone a completely different way with all of it as well. And actually people seeing the kind of initial fallout and then it turning into this actually amazing partnership showed that there are ways to react to those instances that where everyone kind of comes out looking all right, and it ends up actually being a much better thing for the brand. In a lot of ways. So I'm glad that it ended up the way that it did. But I think it was a very, it was not a fun time to be doing the job that I was doing and to be on be on probation in that job as well.
God. So after L'Oreal, am I right in thinking that you go to Charlotte Tilbury? That's the next step.
Yes, that's right. So I then, after a few years at L'Oreal, I became the global advocacy manager for Charlotte Tilbury, which was kind of looking after, it was myself and a colleague were kind of the heads of the influencer strategy for all of the markets, and we would kind of help the teams in the different markets come up with their strategies and roll out whatever we were launching or whoever we were working with across the whole
world. And that was really going from an institution like L'Oreal. Charlotte Tilbury, wasn't that founded in like 2013? So it was actually just a very, you know, well-funded, just explosive kind of startup.
Oh my God, it was crazy. Yeah, it was. And even people that I was talking to at the time, you know, we'd be speaking to press or talent and, you know, we'd say, you know, it's our 5-year anniversary coming up, and they'd be like, what? Sorry, I thought the brand was like 35 years old. And it's, I guess it's testament to Charlotte's legacy that she's built that actually, she wasn't starting from zero when she launched that brand. It was, you know, kind of the peak of her career at that point, and it's only obviously got better and better since then.
And really her also being an influencer in her own right as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think she kind of, I think she would probably resent this comparison, but if you look at like Huda, for example, the way that she stormed the US, and that was again because she already had the contacts and the legacy and the reputation. People trust whatever she's launching because she's, you know, been touching these products and using them on some of the most famous people in the world for decades. So
yeah,
it was a crazy environment to be in, and yet a very different pace, very different attitudes.
Yeah, what was the attitude towards creators, influencers at Charlotte Tilbury? Was it, as a startup, was it let's see what we can do press wise, or did you have ambassadors that you kind of onboarded?
So they were very kind of, it was a funny one. They were, I guess they would call themselves kind of like influencer first. Like the brand, the reason why the brand got so big so quickly is because it's through the kind of word of mouth. The products are really good. Like
they really are very, very good.
I'm still, you know, covered in them now, a few years after leaving. Like the products are amazing. They really speak for themselves. The reputation is completely founded, I think. And the problem that it's not like this now, but at the time it was kind of its own worst enemy, because people would just buy in the product. You know, we almost didn't need to work that hard because people did just love them. The awareness thing was the main thing for us. Was, you know, we were getting all of these survey results that showed that there was still half of people in the UK had never even heard of the brand. So that was our kind of like, okay, we need to go after those people. But people who had heard of it and had tried it, you know, were kind of just instantly converted anyway. And they were in this culture at the time of not really having an influencer budget. They didn't really have an influencer team like established. They weren't really paying that many people because they didn't really have to. People just wanted to talk about the product. They look beautiful as us. They look, you know, they're really photogenic. It was a bit of a statement to have some of those products on your channel. Because they were the cool thing, it was still new and exciting. Mm. They looked sick. They looked great on the skin.
It's also quite clever, I feel, like with Charlotte Tilbury. You know that it's luxe, but you also feel like it's affordable. But then you go to checkout and it's like, oh no, I've actually spent like way more money than I thought.
Oh my God.
Yeah,
absolutely.
It's like this weird thing, like, oh well, I won't go to, you know,
like a Lauder or a Tom Ford or something.
Exactly. Like, I won't do that. I'll go to Charlotte Tilbury because that's sort of middle of the range and it's just amazing quality, but is,
Oh my God. I know. Yeah. My kit kind of elevated in that the time I was there. But it was quite a journey, I think, to have someone like me. Like, I feel like I was actually quite irritated when I first joined because I was like, I really want us to talk more about paying people. And everyone was like, but people just want to work with us, you know, the products are great, we're saving so much budget for other things. That they were kind of breaking into TV at that point for that awareness, piece. And obviously TV is very expensive, and you know, it was kind of like, why do we need this budget? You know, people are, will just talk about it, and people would. And I would even, I had influencers saying to me, oh, if it was any other brand, I'd be asking for fee, but you know, just give me a bag of products and I'm happy. Or you know, it is like they wanted to be in videos with Charlotte, they wanted to be on set, they wanted to be on her Instagram pages. It was, yeah, it was hard. It was a real conflicting role for me.
I hosted a panel a few years ago, and I feel like it was actually the footballer Hector Bellerin, and he had done some stuff, yeah, I know, with Puma. But he said that the only brands, like, that he'd work with are brands he would work with for free anyway. And so that, it really is the kind of,
and that's the thing, like, that's what, that's how it should be, right? Like, the, I think that the most authentic partnerships are the ones where you were already using the product and love it, and it's already part of your lifestyle. But I think,
but then to have the support where you are paid, you would have done it anyway, but that's just then added.
Yeah, and also it's a job, like, you know, that, yeah, like, moisturizer doesn't pay rent. You need to, and it needs to be a partnership. And I think, you know, the turning point I found was explaining, and the laws help, but the industry laws help, is we don't have any creative control if we're not in a partnership with these people. So yes, we're getting the exposure, and we're getting featured on their channels, but if we want them to say anything specific about the product, or if we want them to go live, you know, on Tuesday before Cyber Week, because that's when our biggest day is going to be or whatever, we need to pay them to do that, because then it becomes a partnership, and it there's a contract involved, and it's more than just try and get as, you know, as much exposure as we can.
Exactly, yeah. And it's more trackable. Yeah. So I think it's that balance of earned media versus the guarantees, and the combination can be great. So you leave Charlotte Tilbury and then you set up your own agency.
Yes, that's right. So actually, I was kind of like, Happy Cat started as just an opportunity for me to freelance. So while I was at, my role at Charlotte Tilbury was a contract role, as is my role at EA. And I knew that, you know, that the clock was ticking from the point I started. We all knew what my end date was going to be. So I had my mission at Charlotte Tilbury and I was kind of working towards that. But at the same time, I was having to think about, you know, kind of what I wanted longer term. I was getting some messages at this point, kind of through LinkedIn, through contacts in the industry, you know, asking for help or like kind of consultation on their strategies. Or it was, you know, my mates launching a brand, can you grab an hour with you to talk through a strategy or whatever. So I was like, okay, I'm really bad at saying no to stuff, and I'm also really bad at turning down money. So I started Happy Cat just as a way to kind of you know, make sure that I was doing all my taxes and everything properly. I didn't want to be self-employed, I wanted to be an employee of a limited company.
Yeah.
When I was taking those payments. And then as it got closer to the end of my contract with Charlotte Tilbury, it was actually getting to the point where there was quite a lot of work, and I was, all of my weekends, evenings, lunch breaks, I was taking annual leave from Charlotte Tilbury to go and spend a day working for a client. And it was getting so busy that I needed to start bringing people in to help manage some of the contracts, because I wasn't really turning anyone away at this point. I made a lot of mistakes at the beginning just because I was so afraid of it all falling apart and, you know, not having anything. The people I brought in were kind of interns at this point. It was all very part-time support, but it just meant that every time a really exciting client came forward, I could say yes to it, and we'd find a way to fulfill what they needed, you know.
Were you pitching to win work, or was it all just response?
I was very lucky. I never had to pitch for work.
Throughout the whole, for everything?
No, every client that we had was either recommended by an existing or previous client, or it was through somebody that I'd worked with in one of my various roles throughout the years. And there were a couple who I'd kind of reached out to them directly and just said, you know, some of them were like proper startups, and I'm really passionate about helping brands who have never touched influencers at all, helping them to kind of understand how the industry works and letting them kind of dip their toes in it, because a lot of startups and a lot of founders really are afraid of this world and don't believe that it has value. So I would sometimes reach out to people and be like, you know, hey, I love your products. Like the Miami burger campaign that we actually won the Blogosphere Award for last year, I reached out to the founder and I just said, hey, me and my husband eat your burgers all the time. I've noticed that you're not really doing much with influencers, but I think there's a lot of scope to do that. What's kind of the lowest that you'd want to invest in it? And I want to prove to you that we can do something really impactful. And that, you know, he was like, yeah, sure. Like, I trust you. Let's try it.
What do you think is the lowest investment or amount that somebody can do to in a test and learn on influencer?
So we did that campaign was, I think it was £5,000, and that covered our fee. And it meant that it was only a small amount of people. So our long list for that campaign was about 30 people. I'd spoken with each of them and said, it wasn't just kind of like a blind mail out. It was,
yeah,
here's this brand. You've probably never heard of them, but I think you're really going to like their food. And can I send you some to just try it and see what you think? And then from that long list, you know, some people said, I never really got around to trying it or whatever, you know, yeah, I liked it, but it was kind of the same as some of the other stuff I tried. But out of that list, there was a dozen people who were like, oh my God, I absolutely love this. You know, where can I buy more? It really, you know, I love finding those true advocates, even if it's, you know, they've never heard of the brand before, but you can see quite quickly who is going to really convey the message authentically and like genuinely loves the product. So then we took that smaller list and we then started to build out the campaign. And it was only, we only did one post for each of those people, but it was across quite a broad range of channels. The majority of them weren't, it was a plant-based brand, but the majority of them weren't vegan. And I thought it was important to show that, because I'm not vegan either, but I do eat plant-based occasionally and I love those products. And I wanted to convey that same thing to the audiences, that it was like, yeah, it's not got meat in it, but you won't notice because it's so great. Mm. And I think the creator that we used did such a good job of making the products look great. They genuinely loved them. So that helped. The brand were really pleased with the way that they were presented and the reaction that they had from consumers, from all the new followers they got, the new customers they got. It was, yeah, it was one of the smallest things I've ever done, but it was so successful, I think, for all of the reasons that I love the industry.
And then, so you mentioned there that the budget covered your fee. When with agencies and what we're seeing, do you think that there is like transparency on like fees?
Not enough, I don't think, honestly. Yeah.
What's the most shocking that you've like experienced and sort of uncovered how much of a budget actually was from a client, and then how?
I think the ones that really shocked me are the talent management agencies. Like some of them, like I've heard some of them taking up to 50%, you know, some of them take 30%.
Which really an industry standard is sort of 20.
Yeah, exactly. Like there are a lot who are taking more than that. And actually, I think a lot of talent signed to management not really knowing what they're getting into. And there was an issue at the beginning of the industry where people were signing onto these like really long contracts, having no idea where their career was going to go. And I still mentor a lot of creators now who get offers for like 3-year contracts. And I'm, you know, try and really discourage creators from going down that route, because you could have another million followers in 3 years time and your value will be completely different, your brand will be different, but you've already agreed to those terms back when you had 50,000 followers. And I think a lot of agencies, there was a lot of politics back in the day. I don't know if it's the same anymore, but there would be times where I would ask for a talent to be involved in a campaign. I'd be told by the management that they didn't like the product, but here's someone else who could work instead, and we'd end up working with that person. And I actually had good relationships with the management and the talent, so I'd then see the talent at
the launch. Talent had never
they'd never heard of it. Yeah. No, it's because they'd already reached their quota for that month, but the other talent hadn't. So let's try and push them on to more campaigns. And I just think there was a lot of, I get it. People are trying to look after themselves first. And if you've got, you know, targets to reach, it is a very competitive industry. There's a lot of people fighting for positions. There still aren't that many jobs here. It's hard to judge someone who's like, you know, just trying to impress their boss. Do you know what I mean?
You've mentioned that things could be quite political. I think we have seen people trying to like control or improve, and there have been a few different trade bodies. What are your views on trade bodies, both on the industry side and on the creator side?
I feel like...
And can there be one that encompasses both?
Yeah, I feel like the industry is really screaming for something, like some level of standardization, or like I think that fees in general has always been a real frustration. And you know, there can be two talent who I would kind of categorize as the same in terms of they probably have identical audiences, they definitely get the same engagement rate, the content is largely similar, but one of them has an agency who will make you pay £1,000 and the other one will have an agency that make you pay £350, and it's one of them's either getting undercut or oversold, or both. There's obviously the agencies are kind of involved in that, but I think, like, how do you, I've been part of these panels like a million times, how do you regulate fees? I don't think you can. I think it's just an education thing. It is a transparency thing. The more that people are honest about how much they're paying, how much they're earning, I think talent need to talk to each other more. I've worked on shoots where one talent's agent has negotiated for them to just get a goodie bag at the end of it, and the other girl on the shoot has, you know, they've negotiated hundreds of pounds for appearance or whatever. The same for events. It, you know, people need to be having words with their agents. What is my value here, and how does it compare to even the other talent on the roster, for example? Brands need to be more honest. In terms of the regulations, like what the ASA and CAP are doing, I'm a big advocate of that. I think there is no other job where it would be okay to hold your hand up and say, oh, sorry, I didn't know those were the rules. You know, people need to get with it. You need to understand. I run a lot of education sessions and it still blows my mind how there are people who have been working in this industry for 6 or 7 years who still don't know when they should use hashtag ad or whatever. And it's like, I think everyone who works in this industry has a responsibility to know what the rules are and why they're there. But even more than that, I think the motivation shouldn't be that you don't want to get in trouble. The motivation should be that you want to be transparent and respectful to audiences, and no one wants to mislead. Well, I'd like to think no one wants to mislead consumers, but there is, you know, there's this fear that it will underperform if it's got an ad, but actually a lot of data suggests that it won't if you've got the right relationship with your audience. A lot of consumers say that they don't trust something that's an ad, but I would say that should only be the case if you don't trust the person who's posting the ad. If you trust them, then, you know, why would they be disrespectful of you by posting an ad, you know, or omitting an ad when it is one?
That's a very good point. In terms of, you know, you've mentioned transparency, and you are like very open and vocal on your own sort of social medias as well, particularly on LinkedIn, where I've seen, you know, where, like, are you not afraid of calling out? Or, you know, I mean, it's great, but
I think,
and what are the big things that you kind of have called out? I've seen, some misogyny and some flexible working.
I think I've just realized that you know, I think this is a very extreme comparison, but I recently read the story, the book around the Harvey Weinstein like attacks and abuse ring and the cover-up involved in that. And I think that's, it's a very, very kind of you know, it's a hyperbole of what I'm talking about, but I think the problem is that all of these systemic misogyny, for example, is it exists because people aren't vocal about it and people are afraid of their oppressors or of their aggressors. And I think that the, you know, if there's anything that that case kind of highlights is that actually if you have evidence or, you know, you have enough people who believe your truth, then it actually looks a lot worse on the, in this case, the brand, if they try and backtrack or silence you, or, you know, none of them have ever reached out. I know that a lot of the brands have seen the things that I've talked about, so about kind of being discriminated against for maternity, for during my maternity leave, in terms of not being flexible and offering any level of kind of actually possible role for me now that I'm a parent. Because realistically, if, you know, if I'm going to commute 5 days a week into an office in London, I'm not going to see my son. I'll see him on the weekends and that's it. And I think we've come too far in feminism to be in a position where I have to choose between being really good at my job and also being a really present parent. I absolutely believe I can do both. I've been doing both since he was born in two different roles now. And, you know, my contract at EA is very flexible and I'm still really good at what I do. And I also still spend a lot of time with my kid. And I don't believe for a second that there is any argument, especially in this industry. Oh my God, if we can't have flexible working in this industry, which never sleeps anyway, there is no sector, you know, the internet isn't 9 to 5, whether it's a fashion week, you know, 5 a.m. call time, or it's a campaign that's going live for a product that's launching at midnight, or it's a 24-hour Twitch stream, you know, there's no reason why you need fixed hours. There's no reason why you need a team all in the office together at the same time in the same country. My team at EA are all over the world. I've never met any of them in person. We all work together just fine.
So on your contract, are you full time on a full time contract, or can you do stuff with Happy Cat as
I'm well? On a 40-hour contract, and I can work those hours whenever works for me. I could do other stuff. I'm not, just because I you know, my son is one, so I want to, you know, while he's little, all of the time that I'm not working at EA, I just want to be spending with him. But
And we've talked about that you faced discrimination during your maternity leave in some of the jobs that you would have been good at, but you weren't hired because you have a child. Mm-hmm. In terms of misogyny in the industry, when you're looking at companies within it on the agency side, in terms of the agencies that are winning like the most amount of money, do you think it's still skewed that basically if you are a man that you're going to win bigger client budgets?
I think the industry, it's a big conflict for me, is that this industry was largely built by women. It's one of the first places where women were earning their own money, running their own shit, and like being really on top of things. Some of, you know, the high flyers were all women for a period of time. And we kind of somehow the men, they find a way back in. And, you know, a lot of the agencies now are run by white men. A lot of the, you know, if you're sat in the boardroom at one of these brands, yes, a lot of the people who have the relationships and are running the strategies look like me, but the people who we report into, a lot of them are white men. A lot of them are quite old white men, you know, they're guys not even from this world at all, who are in charge of the budgets and the wider strategies and get to veto anything that we do. It's the same with the agencies. I think there's a lot of work to be done. I think brands and agencies and talent management need to have a real look at the people that we're championing. A lot of brands just stick to the same really small handful of, especially the gaming industry, it's a lot of white dudes who are earning the millions and millions of pound contracts. And there are so many more interesting and diverse and creative communities out there that just aren't being championed and aren't getting that access, because it's this kind of like, you know, it's this cycle, isn't it, of the brand is putting this person on a pedestal, so they're gaining audience and they have the, you know, the early access to the product, so they're the ones who people flock to, so then they're the ones who are getting all of the big figures, so they're the ones that the brand wants to work with, and it, you know, it's about
spirals out of control.
Yeah, you need to break that cycle and start to look at what are the other communities that we need to start rising up
and to be able to support them as well. But it's, you know, you're competing against time as well, and time can sometimes run out. I had a conversation a couple of weeks ago with a female founder, and she was saying, you know, by the end of the year we are gonna have to hire a male salesperson because that's where you can win the budgets.
Yeah, I know, it's true. You like, even in our household, like, this isn't kind of just an industry issue at all, but the industry is kind of a microcosm for it, I think. But my husband doesn't want to be the breadwinner in our family, but, you know, even though I actually have more industry experience than he does in his field, he's a software engineer, I've got more industry experience than he does. I actually have a desire to work more hours than he wants to work, but it wouldn't make sense for us financially to have that set up because he does earn significantly more than I do. And
we
feel kind of like trapped in that sense because, yeah, I can't earn what he does. So he does have to work whilst we have this kind of family that needs that stability.
There are fundamental flaws in the system, which does have an impact on influence marketing when you think about how many women work in it, and you don't want to get to, you know, a glass ceiling where we should be the decision makers.
No, I agree. And that,
rise up.
That is why I'm so vocal on my own channels, I think, because I wish that a few years ago I'd had seen, you know, more women speaking up about the specific like microaggressions that they faced, because I'll be honest, I didn't really know that a lot of that was potentially in my future when I was younger and wasn't really thinking about becoming a parent. And I genuinely was like, I was under the impression that becoming a parent wouldn't impact my career in any way. And I've been very lucky to get this contract with EA, but it was, you know, there was definitely a period of time after 6 different brands had discriminated against me for literally just the fact that I was a mother now. Nothing else had changed in my life. I was actually more experienced than I was, you know, before I became a parent. There was definitely a period of time where I was like, oh my God, I have potentially ruined the last 12 years of work by doing this thing that I really wanted to do, which is become a mum. And I hate that I was made to feel like that. And I want to be one of the voices that kind of either makes brands just rethink what they're doing, or at least gives the power to more women to also speak up and push for things to be better for all of us, so that we don't have to make that choice between being really good at what we do and being also great parents.
Yeah. My final question for you is just what your predictions are for the space, for the influencer space in the next year.
Yeah, I mean, like, I think there's things that I want to see more of. I don't know whether that's kind of where the industry is going.
Well, let's do it, but let's split it two ways then. What do you want to see more of, and what do you think we'll see more of?
I want to see more professionalism, more people taking things seriously, paying attention to the regulations, brands wanting to pay creators more. I just want to see people treating this industry as a business, which it is, and people treating their role in it as a job, which it is. And like, we need to stop with all of this, the kind of like greedy, like just in it for all of the free stuff and the trip invites and things like that. I want it to be, you know, we're creative media partners and let's do something really cool with that. I'd also like to see more collaborative partnerships. And I don't like this, you know, the brand has to give like a really detailed brief and then the creator just churns out whatever it is that's on the brief. You know, creators are experts in their field. I want to see more creators pushing back on the briefs and saying, actually, this is the thing I think will work better. You know, there are so many girls out there who, like the girls who kind of were at the founding of the industry, who are doing really cool creative stuff, and their content doesn't look like anything else that, you know, is part of the same campaign. It's not just to hold up the product and smile. It's like a really yeah. well thought out media campaign. I want to see more of that. In terms of where I see it going, the subscription model is growing, which I love. I love this this more kind of, there's more protection for the creators in a world where they can choose, well, they can, you know, they can put a paywall up, so it's not just trolls can kind of come in and it's a free-for-all in commenting or whatever. It's, you have to pay to access this exclusive content, and it creates kind of more core fan base, I guess, and it gives maybe more feedback if you look at like the Patreons and the OnlyFans, and even like, I know Meta are trialing a subscription model at the moment.
Yeah, I was going to say, what do you think that rollout will look like on Instagram? They'll have badges so that you can see the comments higher.
Yeah, I think that they need to pay attention to like OnlyFans and Patreon, who have been doing this for a while now, or even Twitch, you know, has layers that I think work really well on those platforms. I don't know if Instagram's, as in the community, is ready for those models to be applied in that environment. I think they need to find a way to make it feel native. As with anything that changes on Instagram, people hate it to begin with. Everyone hated stories, and now most people exclusively watch stories and then leave yeah. the app. Same with Reels. People hate Reels a lot, but they perform well and they're much more creative than, you know, some of the other formats that we were using before. So yeah, I think it could work on Instagram. It's working in other places really nicely. I like the layer that it offers creators to kind of have a bit more control over their content and their audiences, and it feels a bit more exclusive, and it's not just everything that you're producing is just out there for everyone to see and be involved with in some way.
Mm. And as it kind of goes back to the beginnings where there were just those really close relationships with your audience. So mm-hmm. I suppose it is going to be the ones that are really engaged that would be willing to pay money. And that's not because they're interested in everything that you're doing, including branded campaigns, but it's for you and they are opting in.
Yeah.
And there's something quite very strong about opting in.
Yeah, there? I completely agree. I think there is, because the best communities already online are those ones where it's like the niche. Like when I'm working with creators, I would much rather work with somebody who has 50,000 followers, but that, you know, 20% of them are really invested in the content and like feel really connected to the creator, versus someone who's got 1 million followers, but most of them are just there to just tap the heart every time they see you looking fit. And like, you know, the comment section is just kind of emoji spams, and it's clear that nothing's actually resonated. And I feel like those people are less happy, the creators are less happy. It's a much hollow, much more hollow existence than someone who's kind of curating this feed with an audience that they have a real relationship with.
Mm. It's sort of a mirror of human life, you know, having five best friends is better than having 50 acquaintances.
Yeah, exactly. And again, I think, you know, look at like the whole like Great Gatsby model of just being super famous and knowing loads of people doesn't necessarily mean that you're the happiest person in the room. God, this got deep quickly, didn't it?
it did.
Versus, yeah, these much more curated and connected groups.
You've been listening to Blogosphere Serious Influence with me, Alice Audley. For more influencer industry updates, be sure to check out www.blogospheremagazine.com.